fight the horses to find it. Bristol said, I put it at the bottom of the woodcar. About then, carriages pulled up, 4 or 5 of them. All in a hurry, the president climbed out looking sick and skinny, his face the color of ham fat. He went without a hat, and for a man his age, his hair flowed admirably back from his temples. He visored his bad eye with a hand and looked around at the fires and the torches. He lifted his nose and whiffed smoke in the air. He looked tragic, and also like he might toss off an impromptu speech about sacrifice and the holy constitutions, ours and theirs, both documents identical, except for a paragraph or two having to do with slaves. Secretary of State Judah Benjamin, balding, plump, and almost jolly, followed him with a fat stub of cigar between his teeth. A few elder cabinet members hustled from carriage to car, looking stunned as fish just pulled out of water into sunshine and air. Davis looked at the mob and at the cadets in what appeared to be confusion. Jeers broke out. Hecklers sang improvised songs with repetitious thumping rhythms suitable for drunks, such as the tune to Battle Hymn of the Republic, but chanting about how they'll hang Jeff Davis from a sour apple tree instead of the business about John Brown's moldering body. Hard to say which version claimed worse lyrics. The world fell apart. Fire blazed everywhere and walls tumbled down. And yet, to a degree, the night felt a lot like a party. Ryland reached Bristol a full bottle of Cuban rum he'd confiscated along the way, and they traded swigs. Davis hurriedly climbed the stairs to the passenger car, and Bristol noticed as he lifted his foot to the first step what a pretty pair of low boots he wore. A remnant delegation of slaves, 3 men and a woman lugging a baby on her hip, shifted bags from the carriage to the passenger car and then went to the boxcar and threw their own carpet bags inside and climbed in behind them. Benjamin followed Davis onto the passenger car. He looked delighted by the chanting, yelling crowd, amused, as if he might break into applause at the unexpected entertainment. He doffed his hat and then hustled up the steps. After the big men disappeared through a door, the mob gathered strength and yelled death threats at Davis and called Benjamin every epithet for Jew in the English language, at least all such words known in the South. Moment by moment, they built nerve to loot the train with support from gutter whiskey and the hortatory skills of angry drunks. Lights in the passenger car stayed unlit, windows black. The train stood still. Some problem to do with the locomotive kept it from rolling away into the night. Steam built and released and rebuilt, and the train stayed still. The cadets were a gang of boys unused to liquor in quantities greater than a raw taste of cheap rum on the tongue, all of them splinter thin from a forced regimen of only 2 meals a day, mostly shreds of off-smelling salt pork and hardtack wetted with false coffee. Sailor food, the officers called it. The boys just called it shit. On the rare occasion they ate vegetables, their insides rebelled and they suffered the runs for days, their bowels working in the manner of a strong woman wringing water out of a dish rag. But, on the other hand, they were left calling their own orders. So they hung together, arrogant, on the rail platform, claiming a space between the mob and the train. They carried their newfound rifles and shotguns slung over their shoulders on straps, revolvers holstered on their slim hips, or just shoved down their belts. They were not in a patient mood for outside opinions on how this next few minutes ought to play. The mob roiled within itself until it found leaders. A man in a plaid suit separated from the huddles and walked 3 steps their way. You better move along, he said. A man in a greasy canvas coat stepped up beside him and flippered out both handbacks loose-wristed, like shoeing cattle. He said, "Get on, young'uns." The crowd focused and quit milling and aimed all in one direction, at the boys. The cadets had not considered themselves guardians of the Confederate treasure train, or of the old men who had led them to this point of collapse. They looked at each other in confusion. Ryland, real flat and slow and disgusted, said, "Well, shit fire." The man in the plaid suit said, "I mean it. Stand aside." Somebody else shouted, "Don't let Jeff Davis and his gang ruin us all and then get off with the money, too. The Federals will be on us by dawn and they'll steal everything not screwed to the floor." Shouts went all through the crowd. "Get what we can get! Get it while we can get it! Get it now!" Pushed from behind, the front line of the mob staggered forward a few feet toward the boys. At that, Ryland and several other cadets unslung rifles and shotguns, and some filled their hands with pistols. Ryland, rum bold, said, "You bunch aim to try us? Really? Y'all?" He said it like there were certainly people who could try them and succeed, but not this particular bunch under any range of imagination. The men paused. "Oh, hell yeah," Ryland said. "Try us. Come on. Get some." He didn't shout to the crowd, but spoke only to that first row of mobsters. He said, "Y'all old men, just step up front and center. See who gets cut down first." He tipped his head toward Bristol and said, "This one here? Best shot among us. Still a kid, but he sure hell can shoot. Not just the fastest, but the best. Bang, bang. Sound like one shot. And you'll have one neat hole in the middle of your forehead and two bullets blowing mess out the back." That was a gross exaggeration. Bristol was better than average shooting paper targets with a rifle, but was no pistolier and had not ever fired at a human being. But he played along. Bristol held his arms crossed in front so that his right forearm rested across his left forearm. His right hand holding the Colt's navy pistol drooped all relaxed and calm. He squint-eyed watched the mob for the first sign of bad intention. A woman in the crowd hollered,
"You and sorry drunks gonna let those children face you down? Whoop 'em and run 'em back home to their mamas."
The mob surged again. Voices cursed God and Jefferson Davis equally for the pain they had rained down on the South. Ryland raised his pistol and fired a single ceremonial shot into the air like the start of a horse race. Five or six men on the front row of the mob broke to run, among them the man who had flipped his hands. He and two others stepped on each other's feet, and then a half dozen fell in a pile, scrambling against each other like a trap full of blue crabs. Some of the cadets laughed, and then some of the mob laughed. Loud enough for everyone to hear, Ryland said, "Hey, do all us idiots need to be killing one another? We all bet on the same broke-down racehorse." The steam engine came alive with a grind of metal. Long iron rods and pins and joints worked against the drive wheels until the whole train jolted forward a few inches, and then shiny steel wheels spun two squealing turns against the rails until friction bound them together. The train began moving at a crawl and then accelerating. Secretary Benjamin opened the window in the passenger car and stuck his head out. He yelled, "You boys, jump on! Be quick!" Quick was what Ryland and Bristol did best. They dashed toward the blue box car and tossed the long weapons before them into the open door and tumbled in laughing and whooping like they'd robbed a bank and gotten away with all the gold. Then, They realized it was only the two of them. The other boys straggled slow and lost behind. Bristol and Ryland let their eyes adjust. The slaves sat in a corner, lit by the yellow glow of two candle lanterns. The woman held her baby close, and her man reached his arm over her shoulders, and they looked only at the baby. The other two men looked only at Bristol and Rylan. The train reached the pace of a strong canter, and then settled in for the ride south. One of the men looked less than 30, very dark, wearing a gray suit and white shirt, and with hands less beat from work than Ryland's and Bristol's, so housework. The other man was a little older. He had a large, round head and had gone bald halfway back. His skin was sort of russet color, and three pale, horizontal scars marked his forehead like old razor cuts. He kept rubbing and squeezing his temples with the thumb and middle finger of his left hand, like he had a throbbing headache. The whites of his eyes had gone yellow. He was a big, strong man, but looked like half the strength had been worn out of him. Rye made a one-finger eyebrow salute toward the corner and said, "Evening, folks. What's Ewan's names?" The family paid no attention. The scarred man said, "Cleon." The man in the suit just kept looking at the boys. Ryland took a chug from his bottle and passed it to Bristol. After Bristol sipped, he reached the bottle toward the two men, but they declined with sliding level motions of both downturned hands. Rye took the bottle back and swigged. "Ah," he said. "We're gonna need us a bunch more of this. They say all the smart people are heading to Havana, and I can see why. Swinging hammocks under palm trees, smoke cigars, and drink rum all day long." "Cuba," Cleon said. "Land paradise. Rum and cigars make their own selves down there." "Not the night for scoffing," Ryland said. "This is the time for hope. Everything's changed. We're all cut loose, possibilities whichever way we look." The two men looked at each other, and then they looked out the wide door. The city stretched across its hill and along the river like burning red hell itself. "Yeah," Cleon said. "Keep talking. You know everything." "I know I never owned anybody but my own self," Ryland said. "Half the time all I can do is half-ass manage me, much less make a bunch of other people do my bidding." The couple with the baby were putting together sandwiches of pork belly and day-old cornbread. "Wouldn't care to share that pone, would you?" Ryland said. "Belly too, a bite?" The man in the suit said, "We got little food." "Break off a burnt edge," Ryland said. "I won't complain. Remember, we offered to share our liquor with you." Cleon looked at Bristol and then looked back at Rye. He said, "If we're all cut loose and free to do as we please, then we might sell you some food." Ryland and Bristol both laughed. Bristol said, "We not been paid in 6 months." "White people all rich," Cleon said, "but they sure go around poor mouthing." Ryland said, "We're not rich. For a whole year we've been fed worse than a general's bird dog." "Beef steak and loaves of white bread then," Cleon said. "Great wedges of chocolate cake." The man in the suit said, "Pork tenderloin, roasted over a wood fire and potatoes buttered yellow, and then the whole plate covered with brown gravy." Both men laughed. "Not hardly," Bristol said. "So no money at all?" Cleon said. Bristol said, "I got $5. "$8 and pocket change," Ryland said. "What I said," Cleon muttered, "rich." "But which money?" the other man said. "Dixie paper," Ryland said. "Hell," Cleon said. "You boys nothing but truly broke." but I'd trade you some food for one of those pistols you got stuck down your belts. Ryland said, you've probably not had experience with firearms. They get you in trouble quicker than they get you out. Hey, Cleon said, everybody else has got 'em. We want one too. The other man said, besides, they're simple. I used to care for the guns when the big man went hunting. Load, aim, pull the trigger. Unless you're drunk, then you just pull the trigger. That's the way he did it. What's the worst pistol we got? Ryland asked Bristol. Bristol pulled a pepper box with a broken grip out of his coat pocket. Ryland reached it to the men, and they handled it and tested out the mechanism that turned the five barrels, and then reached back cornbread sandwiches. After they all finished eating, the man in the suit said, you boys expect this is truly the end? End of what? Ryland said. End of the war for you. For us. The Federals coming and setting us free. True fact, Bristol said. Sunrise tomorrow. New world coming for everybody. Day one. Y'all ever study the testaments? The man said. Ryland said, nah. My mama and daddy was normally feeling so raw from Saturday night drinking they couldn't bother with Sunday morning. The man lifted his hand toward the open door and said, that city on fire? There's a story in the Book of Daniel about the night Babylon fell. Bristol said, please don't say you're a preacher. The man said, no. Ryland said, proceed, Reverend. Well, the preacher said, what I was about to tell was about a big wild party in Babylon. 1,000 of King Belshazzar's men and whores eating his food and drinking his liquor, all of it made by his slaves. Pretty barefoot slave girls walking around serving drinks and fancy food off of big silver trays. Round about midnight, when everybody reached the point of drunk, where you drink a bunch more or else there's nowhere left to go but down, right in front of all these witnesses, a ghost hand appears in the air, clear as day. It's holding a piece of charcoal. A giant hand, charcoal the size of a single tree. It scribes strange words on that plaster wall where Belshazzar stood. Letter after letter lit by candle flames, or maybe pine torches. Letters jagged and crossways as a bundle of spilled kindling. Everybody gets quiet and spooked, and they watch close. When the hand gets done with what it has to say, it turns into smoke. Poof. Gone. King's men, they're all full drunk and his whores too, but they're all scared, and they start sobering up a little. They try to study the words, but nobody can read the writing on the wall. About then, Belshazzar's main wife shows up. She comes in cool-tempered, not a bit mad at all the drunks. She gives the wall a quick look and says she knows a man, the best of all the magicians and palm readers and dream readers. Mojo man named Daniel. Knows the invisible world like the back of his hand. If he can't read the writing, nobody can. Belshazzar sends out orders to get Daniel, and pretty soon big police haul him in. The king promises scarlet robes and gold chains and a job as foreman of all the king's lands and slaves if he can read the writing. Daniel says, no, not interested in the king's fancy clothes and fancy job, but says he can read the writing clear as day. Words from a tongue 10,000 years old. Words for gold and silver, brass and iron. The names of the gods that the king and his men and whores praise above all. Things you can weigh on a scale or measure by a ruler or add and divide and count out piece by piece in order to sell. Daniel says that right that minute, the one instant they're all living in, it's the king getting weighed and measured and counted. and Belshazzar comes up short. He's been using the wrong scales, the wrong ruler, wrong numbers. Daniel says to Belshazzar, "You're going to die before the night's done. Your kingdom burned down, and a new kingdom growing up to take its place." The preacher paused to draw breath, and Ryland said, "I never heard this one before. Does it just go on and on?" "Nope." What Daniel said happened. That night, Babylon burned down, kingdom done and gone. Daybreak, Belshazzar woke up, dead, in hell. Ryland said, "Can you read the Bible for yourself?" The preacher paused and then said, "Yes."
"Who taught you?"
The two men glanced at each other. The preacher said, "I'm not saying." "Law," Cleon said. Bristol said, "Probably that law's not going to apply after the sun comes up. Lot of others, too." They all sat, quiet. Out the door, the burning city behind them had become nothing but a pretty amber glow in the sky. The train rolled toward Petersburg, and the night swept by in blurred gray shapes of houses and barns and cornfields and cow pastures. All they saw of Petersburg was the wrecked landscape of a lost war. The government train didn't stop at the station, just tooted the whistle, but crowds stood around in the lamplight of the platform watching it roll past, hope bleached out of their faces. Soon after that, nothing but black pine woods on either side of the tracks. 10 or 15 miles south, the train slowed for a curve, taking it at a little above a trot. The preacher looked at Cleon and nodded. They didn't say a word to each other, but both stood and picked up their carpet bags and underhanded them out the door. Then, like jumping down a well or taking a leap of faith, they ran 3 strides and disappeared into a future that looked nothing but dark and red at the moment. Fourth Sunday. Saratoga Springs. After breakfast, V sits by the window reading a new novel, The House of Mirth. She prefers books set in New York or Europe, anywhere except the South, because they don't bring unwelcome memories. Laura wanders in, turns back the covers, and climbs into V's bed and immediately falls asleep. When she wakes, she asks, "What time?" 10. "Wake me at 11. I need an ally. My mother's coming for lunch. Are you asking me to join you?" "Please," Laura says. She turns her face to the wall and sleeps again. V wakes her and says, "Dear girl, if we're going to meet your mother, you need to dress." Laura swings her legs over the edge of the bed and looks at the floor. "She'll be horrible. I've changed my mind. I don't want you to see it. She can be nice for 30 minutes, and then it's always horrible. Oh, I doubt she'll be too bad. And if she is, I've seen enough that I'm inoculated. If I can be a comfort to you, I'll come along." "Really? You'd do that?" "I stood in the real White House arguing toe-to-toe with one of the more corrupt presidents of the United States, at least up to that point in time. So let's go back to your room and pick out a pretty dress." They choose a summer frock, sky blue with tiny yellow flowers. V wipes Laura's face with a wet washcloth and powders her cheeks lightly and pats her hair into slight order, the way it looks best. As they walk to the lobby, Laura clutches V's hand. Laura says, "Please don't be frightened." "That much I can promise," V says. "My brother will be there too. He steals money from my inheritance and thinks I'm too dumb to know. I come from a lineage of crooks dating back to the Mayflower. I'm supposed to be proud, but I just imagine a very long card game down in the lower decks, sharks all eating each other for months at a time. Long passage back then. Imagine all the different purses their coins fared through. The sleights of hand, dealing from the bottom. Exactly. But they were all so religious. Except about money. Mother claims they came for freedom, Laura says. Freedom to do exactly what they wanted without anybody getting in their way. I've had relatives so crooked they nearly went to prison. But if you have money, you never actually go. They make you think it for a while, and that's your punishment. My husband was in prison for 2 years. They tried to make us think they were going to hang him, but they didn't. In the lobby, V stops and asks Laura, "When my friend arrives, I'd like for him to join us." Laura says the bigger the group, the better she behaves, and I'll make sure she gets the check. V walks to the desk and writes a quick note and seals it in an envelope. Laura's mother looks late 40s. She dresses expensively, and her eyes rest in her head, hooded as a snapping turtle's. She rises from her seat at the table and kisses Laura on the cheek, and then holds her by the shoulders and studies her at arm's length for an uncomfortably long time. Laura squirms. When her mother finally lets her go, she says, "Well, at least that's a pretty dress. Usually you look like a gypsy in an opera. But your hair is still a mess, and you should get that boil looked at. We're paying the hotel enough that they can surely get the house doctor to treat an infection gratis." The mother's every word leaves her mouth as a blaring pronouncement. The boil is a faint blemish below Laura's right cheekbone, slighter than an adolescent pimple. The brother stands and shakes V's hand and says, "Blount Scott, head of our company's accounting." Unlike Laura, her brother is dark-haired, and it hangs lank and greasy. He talks in a sort of huffy, barking voice rising from a chest constricted by phlegm and resentment. After they sit, Laura scoots her chair closer to V, leans in, and, not quite whispering, says, "A warning. We're all liars at heart." Her mother says, "Imagine living 20 years with someone who thinks that's ever an appropriate comment." "My older sister isn't here," Laura says. "We've never gotten along. She's angry all the time and holds it against me that I'm prettier." Mrs. Scott says, "You've never understood that when your sister was a girl, the Negro servants were so mean to her." "Really?" V says. "Mean?" "Awful. It damaged her forever." "Physical attacks?" "Verbal." "This was when?" V asks. "During the Great Negro Revolt of 1885? Laura stifles a laugh and then coughs. "It's not funny," Mrs. Scott says. "Laura's sister is very sensitive, and they were so sarcastic toward her." "I see," V says. "People can be so cruel." Lunch arrives. Mrs. Scott talks while she eats, and the cavity of her mouth as she works her food makes sounds like a rubber plunger opening a sink drain. Chicken salad and lettuce at various stages of liquidation make repeat appearances between lips and teeth. She holds her fork as if her finger joints hardly articulate, a limp reluctance, as if other people's hands usually do that job for her. She talks without let up, complaining of Laura's expenses. The brother breaks in and goes over the figures exact to the dollar, to the extent that V worries she'll dream of nothing during the night but murmuring voices rising out of a dark fog, saying numbers over and over. 1,000, 5,000, 10,000, hundreds of thousands. Mumbles of millions rolling over and over like a rising tide until dawn. Mrs. Scott obliquely suggests that Laura has derailed her life by developing inconveniently strong attractions to men she hardly knows. "I suppose I should have been a harsher disciplinarian," Mrs. Scott says. You housebroke me by tying me to the potty and whipping me, Laura says. She's so dramatic, Blount says. I was 7 or 8 and remember how it was. Mother only stripped her legs with a willow switch when she was willful, and if she just complied, Mother wouldn't have tied her. The longer she stays among them, the more V believes Laura's family would gladly commission a hole to be drilled through her forehead and a long red-hot needle plunged into her brain if it would put her under their control. Are you taking care to see that she doesn't run off with some boy? Mrs. Scott asks V. Laura's a woman, so I'd advise her against a boy. I'd been married nearly 3 years at her age. Anyway, I'm her friend, not her caretaker, and I'm certainly not applying for the position of mother. Mrs. Scott plows ahead and says, I worry about this little play you're all putting on. She'll fall in love with Hamlet if he's younger than 60. He is, and maybe she will, V said. But I can guarantee he won't fall in love with her. His interests lie elsewhere. Another girl? He's a confirmed bachelor, very resolute. Mrs. Scott shakes her head all weary, like the world has gone too far wrong to comment. Laura endures the conversation by pretending to occupy a whole other scene. She picks through her salad and eats the pecan halves and raisins and crescent moons of celery, leaving behind a plate of lettuce and tomatoes and croutons. At any rate, I plan to attend the rehearsal this afternoon, Mrs. Scott declares. Little to see today, V says, only the boring parts, figuring out who stands where. And besides, the rehearsal isn't until late afternoon, almost dinner. I'll just say this, and you need to know it, Mrs. Scott says, leaning forward toward V. Laura never took blame for anything. That is the source of her difficulty. Failure of personal responsibility. After delivering her mighty revelation, Mrs. Scott sits back justified and sanctified, stuffed sausage tight inside her charcoal dress. Laura says, family trait. The dishes have already been taken away and they're drinking coffee when James arrives. He carries the blue book under his arm and V's note in his hand like a traveler at a border crossing holding a passport ready to present. Oh, James, V says, I'd like to introduce my friend here at the hotel, Laura, and her mother, Mrs. Scott, and her brother, Mr. Scott. To the table, she says, this is Mr. Blake. We've recently reunited. Long ago, he was a son to me. James says all the correct formulas of words. Laura says, so, the mysterious Mr. Blake I've heard V talk about so much. She holds out her hand for a touch of greeting. Mrs. Scott looks at James and then at V. She stays quiet. Blount doesn't stand to shake hands. V looks at James with a slight eye roll and says, Mrs. Scott and young Blount are shy folks and sometimes find themselves at a loss for words in polite society, but I'm sure they're pleased to meet you, too. Laura laughs aloud. James looks a question at V, and she nods toward the empty chair. He takes a seat and says to Laura, you were playing the piano a couple of Sundays ago. Sunflower slow drag. I can't play Joplin fast enough. The title of the song has the word slow in it, but people always play it too fast, showing off. Your version was beautiful. Mrs. Scott lifts her hand a couple of inches off the table and levels her forefinger at V. She whispers, you keep them away from each other. I mean it. One time she ran off for a week with a middle-aged saxophone player. V looks directly at the finger, not a trace of smile on her face, until Mrs. Scott withdraws it. On the terrace, V and James regard the long blue and green view stretching hazy to the west. Between them on a low table, a silver tea tray, and a smaller tray with a dozen tiny triangular sandwiches and the blue book. Was that awkward? James says. Not for me, it wasn't. I like Laura very much and care about her well-being. I tried to distract her family. A feint at the flank to entice them to aim their artillery my direction since I'm well fortified. And toward me, too, James asks. A little. And only because I knew you could stand it, because you're fortified, too. Even when you were tiny, you were. Laura isn't at all. And her mother and brother are predators, and will eat her alive if they can. V drifts into talking about generations. How grandparents and grandchildren so often get along very well. Remove one generation, 25 years at least, and the anger in both directions dissipates. All the failed expectations and betrayals become cleansed by an intervention of time. Resentment and bitter need for retribution fall away. Love becomes the operative emotion. On the old side, you're left with wrinkled age and whatever fractured end-of-the-line knowledge might have accrued. Wisdom as exhaustion. And on the other side, which V still remembers with molecular vividness, youth and yearning and urgency for something not yet fully defined. Undiluted hope and desire. But by fusing the best of both sides, a kind of intertwining consciousness arises. Grandmother and granddaughter wisdom emerging from shared hope, relieved of emotions tainted by control and guilt and anger. I'll assume you're right, James says, but I wouldn't know much about long family relationships. When I was 15, I probably imagined they were all either perfectly happy or ended in gunfire. V laughs and then sips tea. James takes two tiny sandwiches for his lunch. It is a warm day, and V pushes her three-quarter sleeves to the elbows and fans herself with one hand. She suggests James feel free to remove his jacket, but he declines. James asks, "What are you most afraid to lose?" "Now?" "Yes." "Nothing." "Of course," V says. James recasts his question. He asks, "What do you want to maintain?" "Memory, even if it's sometimes false." "Well, then what I'm curious about right now is Washington." In 1849, after the peace treaty between Briarfield and the hurricane was signed, V finally returned to Washington. She was still in her early 20s and wife of a war hero, a senator, soon to be a U.S. Secretary of War. Little did V know that for the next 30 years, she would never live any place for more than a year or so at a time. A gypsy fortune teller with her caravan, red and yellow and blue, knew more definition of home than V would. Over those years, she bought and sold several households of furniture. Some man in a brown suit, shiny at the elbows and knees, maybe a touch of lunch on his shirt front, arrives. He goes room to room, looking over your carefully chosen things like they're trash, makes an insulting offer, which you accept. Then you move on, leaving behind a ribbon of acquisitions like bright-colored snakeskin shed to turn pale as a fingernail and dissolve in the weather. You carry forward into the next future only a few trunks of clothes and extra special books and paintings, a gypsy caravan load at most. That second time in Washington differed extremely from the first. They lived in a mansion a few blocks from the White House. It was beautiful, but she missed the vibrating energy of Brown's Hotel, which had been like living in a dormitory or attending a house party that stretched on for months. However, the upper reaches of government existed on a grander scale than mere congressmen. At that time, a memorable dinner party among senators and cabinet members and their wives sometimes involved slaves hunkering above the ceiling to drop fresh pink rose petals, as if by magic, through grates onto the diners to announce the first course, which she found showy and a bit crude. Those days, some people called her Queen Verena for her dinners, even without petals, and maybe sometimes for her manner. Dumbards usually selected out after one invitation, overwhelmed by the knowledge and wit around her table. Uncle Jeff sat at the head, striking and graceful and stately behind his famous cheekbones and raptor beak nose, looking out from ash-colored eyes that gave nothing away. Candle flame always flattered him, but even in broad daylight, people walking down the street turned to stare at his handsomeness. Because of his health, recent battle wounds, and lingering malaria, Jeff remained slim, even during the years when men thicken in the middle and their bellies declare themselves. He was especially slim if he had recently passed through one of his long, sick twilights when malaria shivered him to the marrow, or when his eyesight burned and ripped with pain at every beam of sunlight. This before the left eye clouded and he only allowed photographs in profile. Even healthy, his body coiled tight, gripped against itself, squeezing and quivering with a force some saw as nothing but raw red anger and ambition. Most mornings on his way out the door, V reminded him that every moment didn't need to be lived on a battlefield. Mostly during V's famous dinners, Jeff was not at all funny. He sat absorbing the wit of others for long stretches of conversation, and then he issued some piercing comment, dry and oblique, benefiting from long, silent reflection. Sometimes just a half dozen words, perfectly chosen. And everyone would erupt in laughter as he looked down at his place setting. Probably a lovely pattern of Wedgwood and Murano crystal that V would sell for pennies on the dollar when the next earthquake in their lives shook everything to the ground. Those evenings were when they became close to Judah Benjamin, then a new senator from Louisiana who enjoyed boasting that he was the first Jew to honor that body. Judah was the only Confederate leader whose memoir V wanted to read, except he never got around to writing one. Too busy after the war with success in London, eventually becoming a Queen's Counsel. In New Orleans, Judah had married a beautiful, wealthy French Creole girl named Natalie, and they very quickly, uncomfortably so, had a daughter. And then Natalie took the little girl and moved to Paris. After he was elected to the Senate, Judah spent a fortune buying and furnishing a grand house in Washington, hoping to lure her back. She stayed a couple of months in that raw young city and then fled back to France. Theirs became a marriage by post. V remembers Judah getting a big laugh at one of her dinners by sharing a note he had just received from Natalie. He held up the paper, her big looping hand. It read, "Speak not to me of economy. It is so fatiguing." V's mother, back during the conflict over the will, had said bluntly that V's marriage would be happier if she succeeded in becoming pregnant. Not the first mother to hold that opinion. But V and Jeff might also have been happier if they'd arranged something like Judah and Natalie, where they mostly corresponded and Judah visited her in Paris for a month every summer, and then went away before they became tired of each other. It was a marriage that lasted decades upon decades. But V didn't move to Paris. By her middle 20s, after the treaty between Briarfield and the hurricane, she began having babies, and that went on for more than 10 years. She stopped calling her husband Uncle Jeff, and started calling him Banny, a Celtic term of endearment. Husband. A bellboy arrives and hands V the fat book she had asked him to bring down from the desk in her room. She opens it and reaches out to James. A passage is marked in pencil. "Read this," she says. "You're always shoving your Miss Botoum at me." He takes the book and turns it over to look at the spine. It's a volume of her own from 20 years ago. her completion of Jeff's memoir. James begins reading to himself, but she stops him and says, "Aloud, please. It's about famous people I knew back when I was young, presidents and so on. Those times in Washington we're talking about." James says, "When these august shades rise before me, whose active lives had been lived before I grew to womanhood, the responsible, serious youth that fell to my lot is not a subject of regret. The history of their day has to me a very stirring interest, and as I read the chronicles of their deeds, they stand clothed in their well-remembered personality, struggling with united minds for the whole country, holding the interests and possessions of all equally sacred, and pledged to protect these with their lives." After a long pause, he says, "Lovely thoughts." "No," V says. "Words, worth less than a pail of horse biscuits, which could at least fertilize a tomato plant." "I went to New York City last week to visit Julie's family, and I spent 2 afternoons in libraries reading about you in histories and memoirs and newspapers." "Interesting." "Yes, it was. But why did you do it? Go checking up on me?" "Not my intention. I want to understand as much as I can about what you're telling me, and I came away with a question. In some of the things I read, a couple, I was described as your pet." "Who did?" "We don't have to get into personalities. I'm asking if there is any truth to that view. If you're leveling charges and concealing your witnesses, I refuse to defend myself." They remain quiet for half a minute, and then V says, "There were plenty in Richmond who needed to make up stories to explain why at the Gray House you lived upstairs in the nursery with my children rather than downstairs. They gossiped about my race from the day I arrived. My skin, my dark eyes and hair, the shape of my mouth and nose, every tiny bit of me used as evidence as to whether I was mulatto or squaw, their words. And then, after I found you, people came up with all sorts of conspiracies about your origin. Some said you were my son with Jeff, but that my percentage of black blood came out strong in you, and we sent you away at birth. But then I couldn't forget you and forced Jeff to bring you back and worked up a crazy story of finding you on the street to explain it. Others said you were Jeff's son with a slave mother from Briarfield. One of those many illegitimate children he was supposed to have. Indian babies up in the northern wilderness, black babies on Mississippi plantations. Both sides claimed your arrogant nose looked like his. More evidence for their conspiracies." James reaches up and touches thumb and forefinger to the wings of his nose and then taps the tip 3 times. "Arrogant," he says. "I always thought of it as confident. Some of the things I read said I was Negro. Others needed to break it down into smaller fractions. Mulatto, quadroon, octoroon. Those words don't matter to me. The word I can't get past is pet." V, immediate and vehement, says, "I cannot believe I'm sitting here having to listen to this, having to explain. You're a teacher. What's a teacher's pet, a favorite? Usually because they're alert and present, smart and teachable, the ones who repay your effort 5 times over. A favorite little animal, it means that, too. I won't be responsible for your witnesses needing to apply skin color to every personal interaction. Strange to let that outer 100th fraction of our bodies be so important. I'm guessing your Miss Botoum was one of the people calling you my pet. Which way do you think those people meant the word?" "I'll repeat something you said 2 weeks ago. You don't need me to answer that question. After a pause to regroup and redirect, James says, Hold out your arm, please. V reaches it toward him. James pulls back his sleeve and parallels his forearm to hers. See, V says, the difference is hardly more than which of us has been in the sun lately. Plus, I've faded with age. The difference is you're white and I'm not. I don't know what I am, and I'm never comfortable anywhere. I can't remember a time when people, white and black, weren't telling me how well I talk to white people. Both directions, they offer it as a compliment. But mostly it makes me feel separate. If you had been scooped off the streets of Richmond and taken straight to Paris at age 4, you'd be good at talking to French people. That's nowhere near an accurate analogy. No, it's not. Hog Fortress, 1865. Down in the wasteland crossing Sherman's wake, the world had shut down. Loose coon dogs and bear dogs, half wild already, had started forming packs as soon as their owners scattered, leaving them to discover their own manners without interference from human opinions. V saw them hanging at the edges of dark pine woods as her gang of fugitives rolled slowly down the road south. Bunches of dogs, yellow and brown and mottled, with their ribs showing and almost countable, even from a distance. Pink tongues hanging from desperate grins. Only a little more time, 3 seasons, V speculated, until all sense of man's dominion over them would fade, and they'd start taking down stray children and elder folks. 2 or 3 dog generations after that, they'd go holy wolf. Civilization balances always on a keen and precarious point. A showman spinning a fine spode dinner plate on a long dowel slender as a stem of hay. A puff of breath, a moment's lost attention, and it's all gone, crashed to ruination, shards in the dirt. Then mankind retreats to the caves, leaving little behind but obelisks weathering to nubs like broken teeth, dissolving to beach sand. It happened right after harvest time. Sherman's raiders burned their way across Georgia. Corn cribs full, fodder and forage stacked high in conical piles around 8-foot poles. Apples all picked and stored fresh in root cellars for the fall, or sun-dried in leathery rings for the winter. Onions and potatoes and turnips in root cellars. Beans dried in the sun and ready for winter soup. Cabbages still green in the fields, almost ready for cutting. Fat hogs that you didn't want to have to feed for the cold months, ready to slaughter and feast on fresh or salt and smoke for later. A winter's food wiped out, and people left starving. Where did they all go? V asked as they passed a tiny ghost village surrounded by farms. Only one house with light in the window, smoke coming from the chimney. Delray said, somewhere else. Wandering refugee, or off in the woods eating squirrels and grabbling trash fish out of creeks. At a river ford, a blonde child sat alone on the far bank and shouted directions to them as they began crossing. Gee and haw. She claimed there were holes in the river, widely known to be bottomless, and able to pull down entire wagons in their teams. When they reached dry land, V reached her out a few coins, but the girl looked at them and said, Ain't nothing to buy around here. But if you got clean water, I'll pester you for a swallow of it. That river's nasty. It's got dead people in it just laying there spoiling. She tipped her head upstream. Midday, V wandered into the pine woods for what all in their caravan delicately agreed to call a natural break. Men and women both scattered into the trees on opposite sides of the road, though the men only had to step casually behind a largish trunk a few feet from the roadbed and reappear a few seconds later, looking at ease. V and Ellen trekked far beyond sight and had voluminous garments to deal with, awkward squatting and arising and so on. Off in the woods, in her moment of privacy, V thought about Winchester. He mostly taught mathematics by way of Euclid and Pythagoras. Winchester especially loved Pythagoras and his genius in understanding the ratios that order the universe, his declaration that number was God, and also his craziness otherwise, such as his rule that one should always answer the call of nature with back to sun, which was how V had aligned herself. Walking back to the caravan, watching out for snakes, V plucked new growth from the center of a grassy plant, slid the innermost stalk of it free with a squeaky friction, a feel of suction. She put the white tip and the first pale green of the blade into her mouth like a farmer sucking on a wheat sprout. Her weed was an ugly, nameless thing, except she believes that nothing is nameless. The weed's bitter green, beautiful taste carried with it an essential question. Will this thing help or hurt? Be medicine or poison? Thusly, the earliest herb doctors sounded out the world in endless experiment. How many thousands of generations cascaded down through time just to find the healing power in golden seal or ginseng or coneflower root? But surely only three or four to note the poison in pokeberries or green parasols or false morels. The urge to graze in spring abides. The need for something green after a winter of dried beans and potato. Country people called spring greens a tonic, medicine. Back at the caravan, V said to Burton, "We need a huge pot of greens. Any kind you can find." "Yes?" "And meat to flavor the pot. We all need it. We're starting to look pasty as corpses from traveling and living too much on white food, biscuits and grits and flour gravy." She multiplied people, counting children as half a person, figuring at least a quart per person for a good strong dose of greens and meat broth. She said, "We'll need about 3 bushels of greens. A couple of chickens or a pound of bacon or ham will do for the broth." 3 hours later, Delray and Bristol and Ryland came back from foraging with comically big toe sacks paired behind their saddles. The bags bulged with various cresses and mustards and a great deal of dandelion and dock and plantain, even a few beautiful fiddleheads and wild leeks, but no meat. Not even a skinny squirrel. "I found a place with a plenty of hogs," Delray said. "This man's shaped his farm like a fort. Long pine logs axed to a point on either end and piled onto each other in a jagged circle with the hogs and the smokehouse and a pretty white farmhouse in the middle of it. Like he's trying to live inside a briar patch. He's got a pack of big dogs. The dogs and the hogs are all brown and black, and some of them wear their colors in spots, and some go striped, and all of them are so long-legged you have to get up close to tell the difference. I tried to buy some hog meat off him, but he wasn't selling. The man said he and his one boy and 4 daughters and wife have an arsenal of weapons and ammunition they've taken off of Sherman's raiders. 2 Henry repeating rifles for the man and his son, and a bunch of Colt's pistols and shotguns for the women. Said they took the rifles off the first band of raiders and then used them afterward to pour down fire on every bunch that came to steal their food and burn them out. The boy looks about 15 and very chilly. The man said the boy is God almighty fast and can empty the Henry's magazine in 20 seconds and can hit anything he can see without really aiming. That's near a shot a second. Said all seven members of the family share one mind. They stand ready to fight anybody, north or south,